The real question after the New Hampshire primary:
what are the super PACs going to do now?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Wednesday, January 11th.
Coming up, a conversation with the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq.
Are skyscrapers a good way to tell if an economy is about to tank?
And some things never change in politics. Wait till you hear the familiar words uttered by Mitt Romney last night.
Now, those stories and many others just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So usually, Jeremy, the morning after the New Hampshire primary, the winners, such as Mitt Romney, well, they're waking up to extra money in their coffers,
right? A lot of people donating and stuff.
They're very excited about the winner. And the losers are trying to decide whether they're going to have enough money to continue.
Well, this year, Steve, because of the existence of these super political action committees or super PACs, the spending decisions made by those independent groups could be the ones that actually shape the race. They could be more important than the money that's pouring into the campaigns. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Despite back-to-back wins in Iowa and New Hampshire, Mitt Romney still faces five contenders for the GOP nomination, and that may be largely due to the money from super PACs, even though they're supposed to remain independent of political campaigns. Larry Sabato with the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia says unlimited financial support is why even the last-place finishers in New Hampshire are staying in the race.
You don't drop out until you run out of money. Super PACs ensure that most of these candidates won't run out of money nearly as quickly as they would have in the old days when they had to depend on small direct contributions.
Super PAC advertising has dominated the campaign so far, according to New Hampshire GOP strategist Patrick Griffin.
The Romney Super PAC literally took 20 points out of Newt Gingrich's hide in about 20 days.
Still, a single $5 million super PAC contribution has given Newt Gingrich the chance to fight back in the next primary in South Carolina. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, now let's bring in our regular Wednesday guest, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's going to help us dig into some of the criticism that Mitt Romney laid out in his victory speech last night. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
So I want to play you something Romney said last night about the potential economic choice between him and President Obama.
He wants to turn America into a European-style social welfare state. We want to ensure that we remain a free and prosperous land of opportunity.
So, Josh Brown, a European-style social welfare state, is that what the folks like you on Wall Street think is happening?
You know, there's always a little bit of concern from anyone on Wall Street when they see things like healthcare plans, et cetera. But I don't think that anyone believes that that's where we are right now. That really sounds more like Romney preaching to the Tea Party that has not quite come his way just yet.
Well, how much control do you see the president, whoever it is, whether it's Romney or Paul or somebody else or President Obama, who come 2012, how much power do they have over the economy?
Jeremy, here's the dirty little secret. The truth is they can make things really, really worse, but there's very little they can do to improve things. So typically, when you look at who's in the White House, who controls Congress, it's all a myth. There is no correlation. No one is any better than anyone else between Democrats and Republicans. As a matter of fact, if you would have said back in 2008, I can't believe they're going to elect Obama. He's anti-business. He's anti-capitalism. In the meantime, the S&P 500 is up over 50% since January of 2009 when Obama was sworn into office. So I think the president's impact on the economy is not quite what politicians would like it to be.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, this morning, Josh, Jeremy, Hostess Brands, which makes Twinkies, the popular, maybe not so popular anymore, and Wonder Bread filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. It would be the company's second trip to bankruptcy. They just emerged or reemerged from bankruptcy
a few months ago.
Last September, yeah. And as Marketplace's Adrian Hill tells us, there is a name for it.
Who says that bankruptcy experts don't have a sense of humor? You've heard about Chapter 11. How about Chapter 22?
It's a made-up term. It doesn't have any real meaning in the law or anywhere else. And it's somewhat of a joke based on firms going into Chapter 11 two times. So 2 times 11 is 22.
Edie Hotchkiss is a finance professor at Boston College's Carroll School of Management. There are a few Chapter 33s.
I think there may even be a Chapter 44 out there.
Companies bounce in and out of Chapter 11 for a couple of reasons. Sometimes it's an industry issue, downturns causing trouble. Hotchkiss says airlines are a good example of that. Other times, that first Chapter 11 filing creates a tough path forward.
The companies that emerge from the first Chapter 11 emerge weak.
Stephen Walt is a law professor at UVA. He says companies often leave bankruptcy with a whole lot of debt, making it that much easier to get in trouble a second or third or even fourth time. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In Iraq this week, there's been more violence. Roadside bombs killed one person and injured more than a dozen others. Security forces there are fighting to keep order after the vast majority of U.S. troops pulled out at the end of last year.
Well, Christopher Hill is former ambassador to Iraq. He was also U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, where he helped negotiate with North Korea over its nuclear weapons ambitions. And he's with us now to talk about the economic futures of both countries. Ambassador Hill, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, we've seen some violence in Iraq of late, ever since American troops pulled out of Iraq in December. What does that mean, do you think, for the country's economic future?
Well, first of all, I think the country has a pretty good economic future. As you know, they opened these oil service leases to the international oil companies, including with Exxon and BP and Shell. There are a lot of companies in there doing big infrastructure projects, including oil pipeline deals, highways, etc. The problem with the country is they have never sorted out this Sunni-Shia rift. It's a country where the Sunni world meets the Shia world, and it hasn't been easy to sort out.
Oil exports, of course, is Iraq's economy. That's what it's all about. Is there, do you think, a more diversified economy down the pike?
Well, I think there certainly is. I mean, in terms of Middle East agriculture, I think Iraq has really something to offer. But under Saddam Hussein, like just about everything else, that also kind of atrophied. For now, I think the economy is very oil-focused, but in the longer run, I think you'll see it more diversified.
You spent a lot of time in North Korea to lead the U.S. delegation aimed at solving this nuclear crisis. And how do you think that the economy will fare under Kim Jong-un?
The Chinese are always suggesting to the North Koreans, you've got to do what we did, which is open up the economy, get foreign investors in. The North Koreans, I think, are pretty reluctant to do that. And they're reluctant because as soon as North Koreans see what is out there, they'll see that there's a lot better world out there, and that would be the end of this funny little country. So I wish, for the sake of those 22 million people, that they too had a kind of North Korean spring.
Chris Hill is the former ambassador to Iraq. Ambassador Hill, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective, European officials are reportedly on the verge of putting the kibosh on a deal to create the world's biggest stock exchange. Now, Reuters and other news reports are saying that regulators there in Europe will block the multi-billion dollar merger between the New York Stock Exchange and its German counterpart, the Deutsche Börse, as it's called. Those regulators reportedly cite antitrust concerns. From the Marketplace European desk, more now from Stephen Beard.
This mega deal has been in trouble for months. What worries the regulators most is that the merged company would dominate the market for complex financial products called derivatives. The Financial Times in London says the regulators are now ready to block the deal unless the NYSE and Deutsche Börse sell off some of the derivative businesses. Both companies have refused. Quentin Webb is with the financial website Breaking Views. He says this deal is just one of a recent wave of planned mergers between stock exchanges in different countries, and most of the others have been blocked.
If this were to fall over too, the message to exchanges would be don't take any risks with deals that might fall foul either of trustbusters or of politicians looking to protect their home turf.
The European regulator says it will not publish its decision until next month. The NYSE and Deutsche Börse are reported to be lobbying furiously. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Word today out of China, 150 workers at a factory that makes iPhones all threatened to jump from the top of the building if they didn't get a raise. Those workers at the Foxconn plant did get a raise. This is the same company that got a lot of press over the past few years for a rash of worker suicides.
But these aren't the only workers protesting work conditions and pay in China. The global economic downturn means increased pressures on workers there, as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The sad reality in China is that threatening to kill yourself is becoming a common tactic among factory and construction workers who want a raise. What's sadder, says China Labor Bulletin's Jeffrey Crothell, is that many workers are prepared to go through with it.
Workers are finding their wages getting cut back. They're being working less overtime, which, you know, you might think is a good thing, right? But workers on the minimum wage absolutely depend on overtime pay to make a living wage.
Migrant workers in Shanghai stand for hours in the cold, hoping to get train tickets home for the upcoming Chinese New Year holiday. Construction worker Cao Xiaobin says he feels the pressure too.
The price of food is going up much faster than my salary. If this continues, I don't know how I'm going to be able to afford to live.
Some Chinese cities are trying to tackle the problem. The southern metropolis of Shenzhen just raised its minimum wage to around $230 a month. China Labor Bulletin's Crothell says that's simply not enough to live on in urban China. The thing is, Shenzhen now has the highest minimum wage in the entire country. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This week marks a year since Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot at an event in Tucson, Arizona. The weapon that was used in that attack was a Glock 19. Now, even if you're not a gun owner, you've probably heard about the Glock, which is one of the most popular handguns in the country. Paul Barrett of Bloomberg Businessweek has just written a history of the weapon called Glock, the Rise of America's Gun. Paul Barrett, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you write that Glock is the Google of modern civilian handguns. Explain that.
Well, I think if you say the word Glock to pretty much any American, they'll know that it's a black plastic, a semi-automatic pistol. And I think that that is really what distinguishes the Glock. It has come to stand for modern handgun in the richest handgun market in the world, the United States.
And it's an Austrian company. How did it become such a big deal in the U.S.?
In the mid-80s, police departments all across the United States felt that they were outgunned, that their officers were no longer adequately equipped with the traditional Smith & Wesson revolver, which has only 5 or 6 rounds in it. And here came Gaston Glock. He said, I have the pistol of the future. It carries 17 rounds in the magazine, and you need to have it. Like a lot of marketing fads, it caught on very quickly. And once the police were using it, civilians who like to look to the police as a model came along as well.
Now, you mentioned that it is more expensive than an ordinary gun. It's lighter, and it also has a large capacity for ammunition. So has it had an effect on the entire industry? Has it made all guns more dangerous, for example?
There's different ways you can describe guns. The flip side of dangerous is effective. I mean, guns are designed to shoot bullets, which can kill people. In that sense, it has led a trend all across the industry toward more potent, higher capacity handguns. That is absolutely true. And if you think that's a good thing because you're a gun proponent, the Glock is to get credit. If you think that's a bad thing because you're a gun control proponent, well, then the Glock is to be blamed for it. But the basic answer is yes, the Glock revolutionized the handgun market in the United States and all around the world.
Paul Barrett is the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Paul Barrett, thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
A New York City woman who wanted to get out of going to work, Jeremy, faces forgery charges this week. She was arrested on Monday and charged with concocting a jury duty summons she'd given her boss. But the boss noticed the summons was rife with spelling errors, which clued him in that something was amiss, that the supposed court document was fake. Trial was spelled trail,
oops.
T-R-A-I-L. Manager was spelled manger. I don't think they're talking about the nativity on the court summons. So you'd think she would be a better speller anyway because the woman is a school teacher. Yeah. She teaches spelling for a living.
Aww.
So, yeah.
GDP, trade, manufacturing, employment, those are all good ways, Steve, to find out how one country's economy stacks up against
another. We do that every day, don't we?
We do that every day. But here is another way. Skyscrapers.
Really?
It turns out there is a direct correlation between who's building the world's next tallest building and who's facing the next major economic collapse.
Huh.
That's according to a new report by Barclays Capital.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we look at how tall buildings can predict a country's economic future. And here to talk with us is Andrew Lawrence of Barclays Capital, who wrote that report, and he's with us from Hong Kong. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
What kind of proof do we have here? How do skyscrapers figure into impending financial doom?
Well, I've put together a skyscraper index that goes back 140 years. And what I've found is that every time we come towards building the world's tallest building, it correlates with an economic downturn. And in that regard, skyscrapers are probably a good indicator of a misallocation of capital into real estate, excess credit in the system. So most skyscrapers tend to start when credit expands and tend to complete into a recession.
So give us some examples.
So you've got New York in the 1930s, obviously with the Great Depression.
You mean building the Empire State Building?
Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
You've got Chicago in the 1970s. And then the first time that the world's tallest building moved out of the U.S. and went to Asia was 1997 with Kuala Lumpur and the Petronas Towers.
Yes.
And we had the Asian financial crisis.
Hmm.
More recently, you've had the Burj Dubai, which became the world's tallest building in effectively 2007 and completed in 2010. And we've seen a downturn, obviously, in the Middle East since.
Yeah, and not just a downturn in the Middle East, but obviously Dubai had a bailout,
bust, yeah,
right?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Correct.
Exactly. Do commercial real estate bubbles, Andrew, and we're talking about those that are represented by these major skyscraper building projects, do they help, do you think, predict this more than, say, a residential real estate bubble?
I think what we've found is that while we look at the skyscraper index, the world's tallest building, as being a very good indicator of major corrections, underneath each of these world's tallest buildings typically tends to be building bubbles. So we see a lot of tall buildings being built at the same time. And if we look back over the states, there was building bubbles in the 30s, 70s. And in fact, there was a building bubble sort of late 80s, the S&L crisis in the U.S., and we could also see a building bubble in Japan, late 80s, when the Japanese economy, just before the Japanese economy turned down. So we do see a good instance where it's not just the world's tallest building, but a grouping together or a collection of very high buildings being built at the same time has been a very good indicator. And these tend to cluster together. So it's been a very useful indicator of economic corrections.
It's almost as if you say, well, you know, if you see a tall building or the tallest building in the world being built, that, you know,
get worried.
Yeah. Well, not only get worried, but, you know, like, come on, fellas, ratchet it back a little bit, you know, because maybe this could be really bad.
Exactly. And I think also the interesting part about the skyscraper index is it's tended to be quite good on a geographic basis as well, moving from the sort of the center of the correction. So if we went from North America, we went to Asia in 97, Middle East, et cetera. So it's actually picked out regional bubbles or the epicenter, if you like, of corrections very well.
But Andrew, isn't there a flip side to this, which is that those skyscrapers are sort of things that we can look up to, literally things that we can look up to, but also things that we can metaphorically look up to, and they inspire us as an economy grows. We
marvels,
look at them,
right?
And they're engineering marvels, and we like them.
Correct. I mean, I think, you know, they can be very impressive, fantastic for the skyline. But equally, you know, I think the best quote is that it's the architecture of capitalism, and probably capitalism is at most extreme, and therefore tend to come through when we've got massive economic expansions, which typically end in a downturn.
Yeah. Indeed. Hey, Andrew, any guesses on who's next with the biggest skyscraper in the world that we might want to pull our money out of?
Well, there's two building bubbles going on at the moment globally. The first is in China. So China is about to complete 53% of all the world's skyscrapers currently under construction.
Wow.
Over the course of the next 5 years. So China looks like a classic case of misallocation of capital that's gone into real estate and into big buildings. And the second, which is now appearing for the first time on our index, is India.
Hmm.
India to date has only two skyscrapers out of the world's 274. And is in the process of the next 5 years about to build 14.
Wow.
So we're starting to see a building boom in tall buildings in India as well.
Andrew Lawrence is the author of this report on skyscrapers. He's the head of Asia Retail Estate Research at Barclays Capital. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Pleasure.
Well, now to news from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Samsung and LG Electronics have gone organic, Steve. They have unveiled a 55-inch TV that uses organic light-emitting diodes.
I don't even know what that means.
So that means we've got, well, you know, right now
grown.
You have plasma, you have LCD, and you have LED. Well, now we're going to have OLED. Yeah. That's the new one that we'll all have to get. Kind of cool, maybe. But
sounds tasty.
Yeah. So far, though, doesn't seem like anything really earth-shattering has come out of the Consumer Electronics Show this year. John Moe, who hosts Marketplace Tech Report, has been reporting from CES, and he joins us from Las Vegas. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So, John, we've been waiting a couple of days now for some huge product to come out and really blow our minds. You haven't called me to tell me that that has happened. What gives?
Yeah, this year seems to be more about tweaks to existing technology. You have Samsung and LG showing off motion controls for a TV, which is really cool, but it's not that different from Microsoft Kinect. Now, Microsoft announced motion controls for watching Sesame Street, but it's not really a bombshell. There's no real bombshell amazing new inventions here.
But is there precedent for that? Should there have been a bombshell?
Yeah, I mean, this year we're seeing cool stuff, but nothing really compares to, like, 1970, the VCR comes out. 1981, the compact disc. 1996, the DVD. 1998, HD TV. This year, it's just more about adjustments to things we already have.
All right, well, John, I just want to finally ask you, what have you seen that you know will not be a hit this year?
Well, I saw this stick. It's a metal rod that you're supposed to put a camera on the end of, and then you hit the timer and take a picture of yourself. It was described this way.
It's like you have a telescopic arm that goes all the way up to 3 feet.
So no more asking strangers to take your picture now that you have a metal stick.
Very useful. John Moe, host of the Marketplace Tech Report. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, back to politics, Steve, where some things never change. Mm-hmm. Like this line Mitt Romney delivered in his victory speech last night.
You know, tonight we celebrate, tomorrow we go back to work. Huh.
Now, that line sounded kind of familiar to me.
Actually,
perhaps
because a lot of folks use that.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said the exact same thing when he won re-election in 2005.
Tonight we celebrate, tomorrow we go back to work.
And that wasn't the only repeat last night, Steve. John Huntsman used the song Beautiful Day by U2 at his rally.
Yeah, great song.
That song was also used by John Kerry back in 2004. It's a beautiful day. So some things never change, Steve.
Some things never change. I think John Huntsman probably wants a different result than John Kerry.
Yeah, perhaps he does, although after last night, I'm not sure.
You never know.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Wednesday. Of course, check us out anytime at marketplace.org. You can check out the iPhone app as well that we have if you want instant access to Marketplace.
Instant
it's right
access.
There. Instant, right there on your phone. At Marketplace, just check that out in iTunes. And, of course, the podcast anytime. Just a plethora of programming here at Marketplace.
You
that we
can
have
get
for
everything
on
everywhere.
Demand. Thanks for joining us for the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.